Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon. We'll talk about glaciers, books, and visitor centers with guests Mark Kelly and John Neary. We'll talk about totem pole raising. We'll get a preview of this month's Mudroom event. And Principal Kristen Garreau will be here to talk about Homebridge, the school district's homeschool programs for K-12. That's Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and More live at 3 on KTOO. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. U.S. Environmental Protection Agency officials are taking public comment on two applications by PowerTech USA, which hopes to mine uranium from the southern Black Hills in South Dakota. The hearings are reigniting a more than decade-long dispute over nuclear resource extraction and groundwater. Lee Strubinger reports.
PowerTech USA hopes the EPA will greenlight its permits to extract uranium from portions of the Inyankara aquifers located near Edgemont. The process is called uranium in situ recovery. The project proposal seeks to inject lixiviant, or groundwater with elevated levels of oxygen and carbon dioxide, into the aquifer to mobilize uranium from ore deposits. Mark Hollenbeck is manager for the Dewey Burdock project site, where the EPA is taking comment. He says he's certain the EPA will give PowerTech the go-ahead.
We're very confident in our science. We have succeeded in all levels of permitting up to this date. Our science has not fell through. It's been challenged, but we have won every time. So we expect to win this time as well.
According to the EPA, PowerTech plans to use groundwater from the Madison Aquifer to replace the groundwater removed from the Inyankara aquifers. Lilius Jarding is with the Clean Water Alliance, a group that opposes the project. She says they're confident the project will get shut down.
We're absolutely hopeful. We believe this will be stopped.
Why?
Because we've stopped it before in the Black Hills, and because the company is not doing a very good job of pitching its project. It's had some problems.
EPA officials say they're seeking public comment to identify any traditional cultural properties in the project area. The Dewey Burdock site is located in southwestern Custer County and northwestern Fall River County on the Wyoming-South Dakota border. The EPA is taking public comment through May 19th on the permits. I'm Lee Strupinger in Rapid City, South Dakota.
For the first time in 130 years, the Eastern Shoshone welcomed a newborn bison on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming. Yellowstone Public Radio's Bree Ripley reports.
Jason Baldes was hired to oversee and manage the buffalo program last fall when the Eastern Shoshone tribe received 10 genetically pure buffalo from the National Wildlife Federation's Tribal Partnership Program. And last week, the first baby was born among the bunch.
Our ceremonial way of life is centered around this gift from the Creator, and we pray with this animal. That's a deep, deep connection that has never gone away.
Baldes points out a crucial connection between what happened to sacred buffalo along the Rocky Mountain West in the 19th century and what happened to Native Americans.
We're now isolated on former pockets of our once vast territories, you know, Indians on reservations and buffalo in national parks and refuges. And we're kind of in a time now when we can handle that differently. Reconnecting buffalo and tribal communities is a kind of a new approach to restorative justice.
So now, Baldes and his team are trying to set precedent for what tribal bison restoration can be like on tribal lands.
This really sets the stage now for where we begin to talk about expanding range and you know, what we want to see this look like in 20 years and start to move that direction.
For National Native News, I'm Bree Ripley.
The Senate has passed a bill to amend a White Mountain Apache Water Rights Act and a bill to provide the Pueblo of Santa Clara a land lease. Chairman of the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, John Hoven, announced the passage of the bills Tuesday morning, saying they strengthen the tribe's control over tribal water and land resources. The bills now go to the House. Senators on the Indian Affairs Committee will focus on education, federal recognition, land, and the Amber Alert in Indian Country during a business meeting and legislative hearing Wednesday in Washington. Leaders in healthcare and crime and justice are expected to testify. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by BNSF Railway Company, supporting STEM careers since 1990 as a corporate partner of the American Indian Science and Engineering Society. BNSF STEM scholarships available at aises.org/scholarships. Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Welcome to a Juneau Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling. We want to share with you a special announcement before we begin our program, and that is that NPR will replace All Things Considered from 4 p.m. our time for 3 hours with special coverage of the news that the FBI Director James Comey has been fired. The hour-long special will be hosted by Robert Siegel in Washington, D.C., and Kelly McEvers in Culver City, California. So stay tuned after Juneau Afternoon for the special coverage of the firing of FBI Director James Comey. As always, we have a fun program planned for today. Let's look a little bit at the weather before we do that. This afternoon may be some scattered showers. Overnight, some patchy fog, which will extend into Wednesday morning. Otherwise, and this is always the happiest phrase to read, partly sunny tomorrow with a high near 60. A bit cloudy on Wednesday night, but that mostly sunny looks like it will come back on Thursday, dropping to mostly cloudy on Thursday night and continuing on Friday. So a couple of lovely days are ahead. My first guests this afternoon are John Neary and Mark Kelly, and we're going to talk about this absolutely neon-colored, gorgeous book in front of me right now called The Mendenhall Glacier, with photos by Mark Kelly, written by Nick Jans, also a fantastic Alaska writer. John Neary is the director with the U.S. Forest Service of the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, and he's been with us before, as has Mark. Thank you, and welcome. Glad to have you here. My first question to Mark was, Mendenhall Glacier, probably the most iconic thing about Juneau. Is this the first time that you've done a book about the Mendenhall Glacier in your 30 years of being a calendar and book publisher with your wonderful photos?
You're correct. It is the first one. And the reason was, back in 2003, Kathy Hocker and David Job came out with a very good book on it. And I didn't want to compete or duplicate what they had done. So it was really John and Nikki last year realizing that the book hadn't been updated and it was a little bit dated. And they asked whether I'd be interested in doing a book. And the books are very different, but hers was a very good book.
Mark, as always, the photos are stunning. I'm always curious, for example, the panoramic one here of the Northern Lights. How many opportunities would you ever have to shoot the Northern Lights over the glacier? It seems like they're fairly infrequent in Southeast.
Well, you know, what's really interesting is if there's a good Northern Lights photo or a good Northern Lights night, I start at North Douglas, and actually the glacier sits north. Most people don't really realize that, and so you want to be in the north. And so the glacier, the lights that they're going to happen usually are happening over the glacier.
You also have some historical photos which bring into very obvious relief the distance that the glacier has retreated in the last 30 to 40 years. That's quite some perspective. Was it difficult to find those photos?
No. Jim Garrity, a historian in the Valley, was a huge help, and as was the State Library, the Historical State Library. And then I, way back when I was a newspaper photographer starting in 79 here, I took my first picture of the glacier in 79. You know, it just slowly started going back, and we didn't really think much about it until, like, the 90s, and I went, oh my gosh, and then in the 2000s, and then I realized I should have been taking a picture from the same place every day or every year, and I would have this great record, but I end up taking a picture in 1986 and duplicating in 2012, showing the glacier had retreated well over a mile and had vertically thinned 700 vertical feet, like a 70-story building.
I had not thought about the vertical thinning. Certainly the retreat is obvious, but I was unaware of the reduction in its height.
If you think of a glacier retreating or whatever, it's a three-dimensional, like a balloon deflating. It's a 3D thing, front, back, top. Not back, excuse me, front, top, and sides.
And that's what we notice from the visitor center more than anything, is that shrinking as Mark describes it, because the retreat is less obvious when you're looking straight out, but the shrinkage away from the sidewalls of the valley is really what you're noticing from year to year. And then how, for example, at the top of the East Glacier Trail, there's that nice cable area that was a great lookout, and now you can no longer see the glacier from that spot, which is also due to that same both retreat as well as that shrinkage.
Mark, I'm going to guess there are between 40 and 50 color plates in here. I don't know if that's exactly right on. Maybe you can clarify that. But about how many total photos would you be looking at before you make your selection? Give us a comparison there.
Oh, I probably have 15 or 20,000 pictures of the Menihau Glacier and all the various, and the ice field, you know, all the different trips.
And what are you looking for exactly? Are you trying to get something representative or adventurous or comparative? What are your criteria that you use as you're looking through and thinking about the publication of a book?
Well, you know, not every book is going to be like an award winner, prize winning photo. It's a lot of it is just an explanation, you know, and so I don't look for just my very best. Of course, I put my very best in there, but a lot of them are just explains what you're looking at, and I'm trying to explain, and it's, hopefully it's illustrated dramatically, but that's not always the case. It's just, it's just my personal take on it, which is this wonderful playground for Juneau, and you know, we've raised our kids there, as most people have, from the ice caves to kayaking to getting up on the glacier. I've been lucky to have a son who's been guiding on the glacier for 5 or 6 years, and you know, he was always dragging me up there to do something. So, but I think it had to be a broad brush of, you know, the animals and the winter, the local time, the summer time, and just show you the seasons and the spaces and the special places.
Are there one or two that are special to you? The photos.
Oh, this one John's looking at right now, the local time, which is the iceberg in the fall colors.
Oh, and we really can have fall colors
we
here.
We really can,
that
yes.
Brilliant yellow reflected
right.
In the pond. That
perfect.
It's a beautiful one.
It took me 6 years to find that out of my kayak, waiting for that one day when the light was right and the iceberg was there and it all went calm. And I can't tell you how many times I was out there and I returned with nothing.
I think people probably don't understand that it's not just you walk out there and take a photo and, yeah, if it looks pretty good, we put it in the book. There are many, many years and thousands of days waiting, as you said, for that right composition.
Yes, I waited years for this because, you know, you might got a little iceberg or the colors weren't reflecting, or the colors weren't great, and you want it on the right day. But to get all the combinations working together, I think it was at least 6 years of trying to get that.
It's an outstanding photo, really. The cottonwood are just ablaze with a nice shadowed spruce as a backdrop, and that the iceberg pops out. But then you see the reflection, too, and you know, I know when I look at this photo that Mark thought about all of those elements, not just one or two the way I would have, but he put the whole package together.
We're talking with photographer Mark Kelly, who has just published the book, Alaska's Menihau Glacier, and we're talking with John Neary, who is the director of the Menihau Visitor Center. John, I see you have a sticky note on a page. Do you want to read that section for us, please?
Yeah, that's the text that Nick wrote to accompany that photo that Mark was just describing and I was describing. And he loves this chapter because it's called Local Time, which to him represents, you know, much of what he just said with his family out there and the community of Juneau. And it's a really different time than we're experiencing right now, which is really visitor time. It's the spring and it's things blooming and it's nature awakening, bears returning, all of that. This is more about the autumn when we're starting to see things go to sleep. So here's Nick's words to describe it. Summer gives way to autumn as the crowds by the visitor center dwindle. Cottonwoods and willows glow, their colors shimmering in the lake. Bright sun, warm days alternate with brooding mist and rain. The cries of geese and cranes echo down the sky. Spawning salmon swirl in the creeks, and the bears shift into overdrive, foraging almost nonstop. Days shorten. As the cold rains pelt from a lowering sky, leaves fade and fall. The land settles inward. Its breathing slows. Snow dusts the mountains, then vanishes. But as the season progresses, the snow line creeps ever downward. High on the ice field, the first big snows have already fallen. The lake freezes around its margins. Slush ice whispers down the river, clumps in eddies. One clear morning, the lake is sheeted with ice, and the wind falls hard from the north. The dark, cold dream of winter descends. And it's magical words, really, to capture the spirit of what will happen there in November and December as we see the visitors depart for places down south and Junoites reclaiming their lake.
Certainly fitting in terms of the beauty of the words, matching the beauty of the photos. Mark, you mentioned some of the ice cave photos, and they are otherworldly, absolutely. And John and I talked last year about the challenges of the Visitor Center and the Forest Service managing the curiosity of folks, both visitors and locals, going out the West Juneau Trail to seek those ice caves. And John, we talked at that time about the West Glacier Trail being the single greatest rescue call out for the Juneau Rescue Service here. And you mentioned there was just another a few days ago. Talk to us a little bit about the ice caves. Of course, people will want to see them. How are they changing, and should people be going out there to see them?
Oh, that's the question, isn't it? And I've been out, and Mark's been out, obviously. You see the photos in the book. So I wouldn't say people shouldn't. I think that's unfair for something that is such a magical place. But when they decide to go, and who they go with, and what they take with them, these are all really critical decisions or choices for them to make. So winter was a great time this past winter when the lake was over a foot thick, and there was an easy, pretty straightforward access. You could just follow the trough all the way over. But that time has passed, and now it's impossible to get to that same spot unless you have a kayak or some sort of paddle craft. You can still do that, and you can still pull your craft out on a beach right nearby and have a five-minute walk up to them. That would be your safest route if you have those paddling skills and know that the wind can come up really strong, especially on those beautiful sunny days when the north wind comes off the glacier and the katabatic winds really create some waves out there. So I would recommend, if you have the kayak skills and know how to do that, that that's your best access. But certainly you can walk the peninsula. And the problem that developed on Friday night with the group that had to be rescued was a very similar one to what Capital City Fire and Rescue say happens all the time, as does the troopers, which is folks go out and they navigate rather easily towards the big white blob in the distance. But then as they turn back, they're facing this amorphous gray slope of loose rock. And then if they make it up that, they get to an area where there's just a lot of green, and it's hard to tell where is the trail, especially if they haven't noticed the really big piles of rocks, the cairns with the signpost and the 1986 sign on it, which was indicating when that the glacier was at that spot in 1986 or something. So if they don't see those things, they get lost. And then they make the really critical mistake is, oh, we'll just head down to the lake. And as they're heading down, they get on really steep terrain. And not only do they upset all the gulls and maybe Arctic terns that are trying to nest there at this time of year, but then they also get cliffed out because the lake does not lead back to their car. So they call 911. It's getting late in the day. They're worried, et cetera, and that's what happens. So the moral of this story is, if you're going to go to this amazing place, is to really get somebody who knows how to get there and back. That's really important, is go with a guide, someone who's been there. And then secondly, take good clothing and have a GPS track that you lay as you're going out and can follow on your way back. These will really save
and
all of us.
And flashlights. It does still get dark.
It does. It does. Flashlights are good. Extra food, clothing. And then also realize that that cave will collapse sometime this summer. There is no doubt, just the way it has in the past, it will collapse. And we all hope nobody will be in there. If it does, when it does collapse, it won't necessarily be the end of the ice caves, because the stream that is forming it will continue to carve under the glacier until the glacier pulls back away from that stream entirely, which will happen, but probably not this year, because we know that a new one is forming right next to the one that will collapse.
What else should we know about the glacier right now? What's going on out there?
Yeah, it's shrinking, you know, as we referred to earlier, and I think that shrinkage is very compelling. I know it is for me to think about what is the future of this place. And the Forest Service is really thinking a lot about the future of this place. We're planning for it, as a matter of fact, trying to decide what we're going to do with the facilities as people continue to want to come out to see this wonderful, beautiful thing that's kind of endangered. It's like trying to see an endangered animal that you mm-hmm. don't know if will be around in a few years. So there's a compelling reason to come. And yet at the same time, it's getting harder to see it. So we're trying to figure out all the facilities and some of the trails and the platforms and, you know, all the interactions between people. And we're going to come up with a decision probably in a year and a half. But that planning process is going on right now.
When you say a decision, to do what exactly?
Yeah.
Or to not do what
right.
exactly?
Right. What to build and what not to build.
Okay.
That's really the question, because right now we have 570,000 people this summer that will want to make their way out there in a visitor center that was designed for about half that, and parking lots that haven't really been updated in 25 years, and, you know, restrooms that are inadequate in number. So we have a lot of those challenges that are super obvious that we just have to fix. But the question is, how do you fix it? Do you just add more restroom blocks, or do you try to do it in a way that really makes more sense? Like, might you have remote parking and a transit system that prevents the crowding of buses that we see currently? Something like that.
Will there be an opportunity soon for public comment that you're aware of, or is that down the road a bit?
It's every day, actually. If you go to the website mgra-mgvc.us, then Corvus Design will accept your comments on this very plan that they're working on with us.
Interesting. Thank you. Mark, back to the book for a moment before we conclude. I've own and have several of your books, and they're always the 6x9 size, which is easy to hold, and the brilliance of the colors still evident at that size. But why that size?
It's really a commercial decision. Making a big coffee table book wouldn't be viable. A $35 book, I don't think. And this price point is good. And
it's about half that, then, I would guess.
About half mm-hmm. that, $15, $16. And it fits, you know, a lot of people who buy her, of course, the tourists. There's 500,000 people that go there, and it fits that size fits easily in a backpack or a purse. And so the big coffee table book is less convenient. And also, if you sell enough books, the coffee table book weighs so much that it gets a problem in their luggage, because they're all maxed
sure.
out. So
very practical.
Very practical.
Well, you've got the backpack size Alaska's Mendenhall Glacier, Mark Kelly's latest book, with text by Nick Jans. We've been talking with Mark, as well as with John Neary, who's the manager of our own Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Thank you for joining us today. And John, you have one more thing to add?
Yeah, just to say that if they'd like to hear more about the stories behind the photos, there's a release party for this book tomorrow at the Visitor Center.
Oh, thank you.
Starts at 6 p.m., and Mark will show some of the images and talk about sort of why he selected them for the book and what their story is. And you're welcome to come out and see the Visitor Center. There will be no cruise ships in at that time, so it's kind of local time at the Visitor Center, and it's free, and come on in.
Tomorrow night, 6 p.m. at the Visitor Center, the so-called launch party for Alaska's Mendenhall Glacier. And, Mark, you'll be there presenting some images as
yes,
well.
Yes, a little short presentation. And actually, people should come out. They redid the gift shop out there, and it's beautiful. It's a whole new redesign. And it's a whole new place.
Yeah, Discovery Southeast is in charge of that now. You might know that organization as a youth education organization, and we're really proud to be partners with them.
So it's a launch party in more than one way.
It is.
6 o'clock tomorrow. Gentlemen, thanks for joining me and for bringing the color of our wonderful glacier into our studio.
Thank you,
Lori. Thank you.
I'd be carried by the ice.
I'd be carried by the
sea. was right.
I'd be at a ready.
I'd be at a ready.
Out on my own.
Out on my own.
Far from my home.
Far from my home.
I'd be carried by the ice.
Carried by the ice.
Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 9th of May, 2017. It was on this day, 1960, the Food and Drug Administration approved the sale of the first commercially produced birth control pill, Enovid 10. At first, drug companies were afraid to market it for fear of boycotts by religious groups, but there was a change in American culture. More women wanted to stay in college even after marrying, and to delay having children for their careers. It was a tiny pill, discreet, affordable, almost 100% effective, cost 11 cents to manufacture. It was the first medicine ever designed to be taken by people who were not sick. Today, the number of women completing 4 years of college is about 7 times what it was before the pill was introduced. It's the birthday of the poet Charles Simic, Belgrade, Yugoslavia, born 1938. After the Nazi invasion, his father was arrested, thrown in jail. Simic didn't see his father again for nearly 10 years until the family reunited in Chicago in 1954. In Belgrade, he loved American movies, the asphalt jungle, the naked city. He looked at pictures in Life and Look magazine, pictures of America. First poem he knew was good, he said. He wrote in New York City a poem called The Butcher Shop. He was working odd jobs, house painting and selling dress shirts in clothing shops. It was on this day, 1994, South Africa's newly elected parliament chose Nelson Mandela as the country's first democratically elected president. More than 22 million South Africans voted, first time that black citizens had been allowed to participate. Mandela was the overwhelming winner. He had served nearly 30 years of his life as a political prisoner of the South African government under apartheid. He spent most of his sentence in a small cell, no bed, no plumbing. He worked in a quarry. He was allowed to write and receive only one letter every 6 months, and his visitations were limited to 30 minutes per year. And it's the birthday of Billy Joel, born in the Bronx, 1949. Dad was a classical pianist. Billy learned the piano, too. Father left when Billy was 8. Money was very tight. He fell in with a rough crowd, took up boxing, and then decided to make music his career. Dropped out of school, worked on his first album, Cold Spring Harbor. Moved to Los Angeles, took a job playing in a lounge on Wilshire Boulevard, which inspired his first big hit, Piano Man. Billy Joel said, "I never wanted to be a nostalgia act, but I suppose I am, but I listened to Beethoven, and that's really old stuff." Here's a poem for today by Rosie King, In Spring. I'm out with the wheelbarrow, mixing mulch, a mockingbird trills in the pine, then from higher, a buzz, and through patches of blue as the fog burns off, a small plane pulls a banner, red letters I can't read, but I do see over the fence a man in a sky blue shirt walking his dog to the beach. He says he missed it, we'll keep an eye out. 4 barrows of mulch around the blueberry bushes, I'm pulling off gloves, and he's back, beaming. It says, "I love you, Martha." Are you Martha? A poem by Rosie King, In Spring, from her collection Time and Peonies, published by Hummingbird Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive Insurance, committed to offering a streamlined shopping experience where home and auto can be bundled together. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Juneau Airport Shuttle, beginning May 15th, providing regularly scheduled service to and from the airport and 3 downtown locations, all flights every day. For more information and online booking, JuneauAirportShuttle.com.
And welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling. In the studio with me right now is Norma Shorty. She is a curriculum author with the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, and John Morrison, who is on the board of directors of the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, as well as with the Douglas Indian Association. Norma is with the Teslin Tlingit Council. Welcome. We're going to talk about the May 13th, which is this Saturday, raising of a totem at 10 in the morning at Gastineau School. This is momentous. Why Gastineau School? When we were chatting a little bit earlier, I wondered if it might be related to the discovery of some burials there about 5 years ago when the school was being remodeled. John, can you address that? Is there a relationship between that event and the totem?
Yes, I can. Thank you. The Gastineau School was actually built over a graveyard over in Douglas. To begin with, I can really actually give you some of the history of what's going on there. The graveyard actually extended out across the street from the school and down over the bank of Douglas. When they put the road, the original road was actually down on the water side, but when they put the new road in back in 1936 or so, when the bridge was being built, they put the road up where 3rd Street is right now. They had to relocate some of the graves from there. Some were moved across the street, as well as some to the Evergreen Cemetery here in Juneau. So 5 years ago, the school was being remodeled by a construction company and had unearthed 3 graves that were right outside the door. I was called over there to have a look and see what was going on. Some artifacts were also unearthed. We had put those into safekeeping and also took some of the actually put the remains back where they were, but some were also being held in security for when we are able to put those back. We held some cultural and elder meetings on this subject, and they really actually were very sensitive and hard feelings over this. And some comments that were made at the time were to actually close the school and reclaim some of that property. Council had to get together and put a stop to this and say, no, this, it's a school. It's already been built. We have children going there, and we didn't, you can't undo what's already been done. So let's continue with what we're doing. We'll leave it as a school, but we need to start correcting some of this injustice that had been done. So, therefore, with Gold Belt Heritage, as well as Doug's Indian Association, in partnership with the city and borough of Juneau, came up with a plan to do a couple totem poles in recognition of those injustices. One totem pole is now complete and going to be erected this coming Saturday, May 13th at 10 o'clock. It is the Raven Pole. It is a healing pole. Also, we have decided that it should be included in some of the curriculum that for the young kids that are going to school so they know the history of that area.
That makes a strong connection and helps sustain that knowledge then through the next generation. Norma, do you want to talk a little bit about the curriculum development that is going to accompany this pole as well as the situation that it commemorates?
Yes, sure. So the curriculum that we're developing is NAGPRA, so it looks to the Native American Graves Repatriation Act. And it discusses the education of this place. So instead of focusing on injustices in other parts of the United States, or we're now looking to this place. So we're developing those units to be specific to here. And so NAGPRA looks at the Gastineau Community School, the issues there, the souls that were unearthed, and it speaks to that. And so really what the lessons do is it looks to the person and their identity regardless of who they are, so Tlingit and non-Tlingit, with the idea of healing going on in this community, so this type of thing never happens again. And that's more or less the the real focus of the NAGPRA curriculum. And but I would like to say that the curriculum is not sort of the focus. What is the focus really is what is happening right now with regard to healing our community and healing ourselves with regard to the loss of language, the loss of culture, as well as the loss of our sacred lands and so many losses in our ways of knowing and being. And so it is to join hands with our community, the community of Juneau, to say we all need to heal from this because we're in that place now of looking back but looking forward as well to form stronger, better relationships, not only here in these circles, like here in this radio world or out there in Juneau, but also in our school. So we're attempting to bring it to the forefront on all and from all venues in all ways.
We're talking with Norma Shorty as well as John Morrison. Both are associated with the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, and we're talking about the raising of a totem at Gastineau School this Saturday at 10 a.m. The artist is Nathan Jackson, a well-known carver. Can you give us, either one of you, a short description of what will be included in the healing pole? You mentioned a raven pole, but totems have many figures on them. What else would be included in the pole to convey healing?
The totem pole has figures of the raven, Moati, the Akwan, which also occupies this part of this territory, the Takukwan Yanidi people, or have laid claim to this part of Southeast Alaska for generations and generations. The Taku area, the Yenyedi people have fished and gillnetted the Taku River for generations and for generations. My father, myself, my grandfather, many of my ancestors have used that river for many, many, many generations. The Raven totem pole has figures representing the frog clan, as well as other figures. It's a healing pole, and there are actually two totem poles that are going to be erected in Douglas. This being the first one, it's the Raven one that's going to be placed at the Gastineau School. The second one will also be the Eagle Wolf totem pole that will be erected at Sandy Beach at a turnaround down there, and it will be honoring the Takuquan Yenyedi people.
Which had a community there.
Yes. The I'm one of the last Takuquan Yenyedi people that used to fish the Taku River during the 40s and the 50s, and we had a community, an Indian village of about 20 houses that lived for generations upon generations in that area, even before gold mine in the 1880s were discovered here. The area that was picked by the Yenyedi people had a saying of why they picked that certain area, and the saying was that it was where the sun rays touched first in the morning. The village does not exist anymore due to the burning of the village, and there's a long history. I can share that if I need to, but probably not at this time.
Well, thank you so much both to John Morrison and to Norma Shorty. Both are associated with the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. And please join them and others at 10 o'clock this Saturday morning at Gastineau School for the raising of the Nathan Jackson Raven Pole. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And if I could just add that the ravens that are sitting on top of the pole are looking towards the inland. So that's part of the healing as well, is that the borders that were put in place have separated families and our nations that are, some are in Canada and some are in the United States. And I'm from Teslin, and I'm here under Jay Treaty working and living among the coastal people where we originated from. And so it is that whole story of contact and colonization that wiped our memories nearly clean of our history and who we are. And this totem pole represents all of that, and it includes the Tlingit from the inland, from Canada. So we don't say we have any U.S. Tlingit or Canadian Tlingit. We are Tlingit people.
Looking
and
over
so that
artificial
is,
border.
That is kind of, you know, the main premise, and as well as acknowledging and commemorating the souls that are buried there, and to honor those ancestors and to bring forward their names and to ensure that that memory never goes away.
Thank you so much.
Gunachish.
Gunachish.
This is Bird Note. The dense cover of coastal chaparral supports many birds found nowhere else in the world. We're listening to the bouncing ball song of one such special bird, the wren-tit. This long-tailed brown skulker is characteristic of the chaparral of California's southern coast. Its closest relatives live far away, skulking in similar vegetation around the Mediterranean Sea. The plant species are different, but the chaparral of California is much like shrubby coastal vegetation in southern Europe, South Africa, southern Australia, and Chile. All of these regions have what is known as the Mediterranean climate. Hot, dry summers, and mild, rainy winters. No rain in the growing season limits the vegetation to a dense cover of shrubs. The shrubs are evergreen, and their small, thick leaves are able to withstand the summer drought. In spring, they bloom profusely and beautifully. The chaparral comes alive then with the songs of birds, among them this California thrasher. Our chaparral is one of the most limited habitats in the world. We're fortunate indeed to have it, and its beautiful singers. Today's show brought to you by the Lufkin Family Foundation. I'm Michael Stein.
Healthy Smiles are here. On May 22nd, Search will open the doors to its updated and expanded Children's Dental Clinic. Staffed by board-certified pediatric dentists and outfitted with the latest in pediatric dental technology, the new clinic will provide your child with a lifetime of healthy smiles. All kids' smiles welcome, from the first tooth to 17 years old. Call 789-KIDS to make an appointment for your child today. This message brought to you by Search.
And thank you for staying with us on a Juno afternoon. Our guests are Alita Buss and Steve Suing with Mudrooms, the monthly storytelling opportunity that invites seven speakers to speak for about 7 minutes, and the donation suggested is $7. You are about probably in your seventh year. That's just a guess, Alita, is that right?
We're just wrapping up season six, so next season we'll be starting our seventh season.
And we should note that this is the end of this season, which runs from September then through May. Steve, you want to talk a little bit about the series this year and whom the beneficiaries were?
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having us here.
You bet.
You know, every season is successful. We bring the community together. We find seven people to take the stage at every event. We usually find a musician, and everyone that attends has a great time, and the feedback that we get is really great. So season six was no exception. It was definitely a very successful season. To date, for all six seasons, we've passed on just over $75,000 to nonprofits here in the community. And this year, we were very happy to pass along four of the events to the Zach Gordon Youth Center and some of the food they provide for after-school activities. We gave one event in January to KTOO, who's been an awesome partner from the start, a very successful event. And the last four events have went to the Polaris House. And they've been great to work with as well as with all the beneficiaries. One thing that people might not realize is that we are not a nonprofit organization. These are just a group of volunteers. I like to call it an organization. But a group of volunteers that come together, believe in storytelling. And so the people that you usually see as you come to Mudrooms and give your $7 cash donation to, those are people that are with the beneficiary. So the Zach Gordon Youth Center, they staffed for the first four events. KTO had a great staff there for the January event. And the folks at the Polaris House have been excellent to work with in welcoming people to the event and being friendly faces as people come in to hear the stories.
Alita, what were some of the themes this year?
Yeah, so we had Rude Awakenings. It was kind of a heavy one, and we had...
Smokin'. I think that might have been Leo's favorite.
That's a broad, potentially broad topic.
I think In the Kitchen might have been a theme, and that sort of is a common denominator for all of us. We had some entertaining chef stories gone wrong. What else?
Chichaco led off the season, and a lot of us... that have lived in Alaska for quite some time knew what that was, but as we started kind of pitching storytellers to tell stories, it was kind of hard to find them. So that led off the season in September.
But so if you're new, if you're listening and you're new to Juno, you're one of those. There's the definition right there. Yeah.
So another thing we want to do is definitely thank the storyboard members. There's seven of us. Alita and I are both on the storyboard. Tom Cosgrove, who's been there from the start.
Sure.
Rich Moniak, Pat Roach, Sarah Hannon. Kristen Stouter, who unfortunately, this is going to be her last Mudrooms. She's moving out of Juno. And Amanda Compton, who was one of the founders with Alita. Think about her often. Every time we take the stage, that this was her brainchild to some degree. And everyone's definitely reaping the benefits 6 years later.
Alita, should everybody think about maybe telling a story? Or is it just people who are maybe have a little bit of training in theater? Who's a good storyteller?
I think everyone has a story. We encourage people who don't have good public speaking skills necessarily. People who might find the idea of speaking in front of 250 people to be intimidating to sign up. I think, you know, we do offer story coaching as a board. So if you have a good story and you want it and you want to tell it, I would say don't be intimidated by being on stage necessarily. We'll have somebody work with you. You can practice through it. And so, you know, we really want these to be raw, heartfelt stories, not too polished necessarily.
Sure.
And that's kind of one of our goals, is to have it be a really wide variety of people.
And do you have a website where if somebody was interested in giving it a try, they could contact you through the website?
That's an excellent lead-in. One of the things we're going to do tomorrow night is we're going to announce the beneficiaries for season number 7, and we're also going to announce the themes for season 7. And within a couple days, those will be posted on mudrooms.org. And, you know, we're going to go dark for the next 3 months. But if you need your mudrooms fix, go to mudrooms.org, hit the sign-up link, and that will have all of the themes listed. And you can sign up there right there through our email. And also, if you heard a story during the season or missed one of the events, all of our stories are archived there as well. So you can listen to one or two as the summer progresses. I would like to say there's a couple folks in the community that we've talked to over the years that we'd really like to see sign up. And a lot of times the feedback they give us is like, there's just not a theme that really speaks to me, or I don't have a story. And so we're really hoping that for season 7, we get to see Ben Brown or Andy Klein, Scott Burton, or Jordan Nigro.
No excuses for any of them.
That's right.
That's right.
They've all been amazing supporters in various ways. And we've all hit them up numbers of times to tell a story, but I hope when those themes come out tomorrow night, they're jumping on our website this weekend and signing up for one of the Season 7 events.
Well, they've been called out. Well, the final session of Mudrooms for this season is tomorrow night at Northern Light United Church. That's on B Street, downtown in the Flats. It's at 7 o'clock. A $7 donation is asked for. And you'll see 7 terrific storytellers and some music. And we're talking with Alita Buss and Steve Suing about this season 6, and season 7 will launch in September. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for your time.
Support comes from the Alaska Robotics Gallery, offering art that features narwhals, squid, and flying whales, located at 220 Front Street in downtown Juneau. More information at alaskarobotics.com.
I have the pleasure of listening to Richard Thompson in the music there. He will be a Juneau Jazz and Classics performer on Saturday, May 20th, closing out the series. He was with the group Fairport Convention, which for folks my generation might remember them. Hi, Kristen. How are you?
Hello. I'm good.
Good. We're talking with Kristen Garreau. She is a principal in the Juneau School District of some of our alternative programs, including Montessori, Yokuska Dakahiti Alternative High School, and our subject this afternoon, which is Homebridge. That's the district's homeschool program for grades K-12. How does it work?
That's a great question. So our program is really a way for people to individualize educational plans for their kids. And we work with families to put a plan together who would like to homeschool their children. And anyone in K all the way through high school can enroll in our program and get an allotment of funds to use to purchase materials and courses as they see fit and put their plan together with the consultation of our teacher that we have, and make a plan.
About how much money would a family get in a ballpark, depending on, what grade level their child is in. I guess that might
it does
be a
change
little bit
a little
different.
Bit. The upper grades are a little bit more, and it's closer to $3,000, and the lower grades are it's closer to $2,000.
And if I recall, students at the secondary level have the opportunity to take live classes as well, so their schedule could look like maybe a university class and a class at one of the brick-and-mortar high schools, maybe gym or chemistry, something they can't replicate
yep.
otherwise.
Right,
so,
exactly. So students can, any homeschool student in the state of Alaska can enroll in a brick-and-mortar neighborhood school for high school for a couple of classes.
And they can try out for sports teams
yep,
or
they
clubs.
They can be attached
or,
to yeah. a school and participate in activities at those schools. So we have students who do that actively in our program. But yes, you can take in our program, you can take up to two classes at the high school, and it doesn't subtract from your allotment that you get. So then you can still use the other money to buy university classes or other correspondence classes to fill out your schedule.
What if you think a smaller opportunity, more personalized, would be good for your child, because you know your child better than anybody, but you don't feel confident as a teacher? Is there some in-the-box curriculum? Can you hire a teacher? Could students go to, say, a school that's housed in a church, for example? What about those options?
So, great. We have some limitations in our program. It's a public, our funds are public funds, so that money can't go to any religious institution. So you couldn't enroll your kid in a church school and use those funds for that. However, you can, with our help, we can direct you to different online resources that you can use to craft a class. There are elementary school classes in a box that you can use that would guide you as well. We have some resources in our office that we can help families with, and we have an experienced teacher who runs our program who's herself homeschooled her children and so has a lot of expertise with elementary, especially to help craft a plan that fits for your family.
What about students who have special needs? Federal law requires that they receive accommodations and modifications. How can that happen if a child is being homeschooled?
So any child who's in our program who qualifies for special education services has an advocate in the school district who works with them, and an IEP team meets together just like they would if you were attending your neighborhood school.
Meaning an individualized education plan.
Right, thank you. And so that team gets together and helps to put a plan in place to support that child. So there are ways to support the kids even if they're at home for most of the time.
We're talking with Kristen Garreau. She is the principal of alternative programs in the Juneau School District. We're talking specifically about the Homebridge Homeschool Program, which can be used for grades K through 12, and the family receives a cash allotment through a reimbursement process for whatever combination they put together for their kids. So, Kristen, give us the nuts and bolts, website and phone number
yeah.
that families can explore this a little bit more, actually enroll.
Great.
And they can enroll now.
They can enroll now. We are enrolling now for the fall. Give us a call in our office. It's 523-1820. And you can also go to the school district website, junoschools.org, and find the link to the homeschool program, Homebridge, on the district's website.
Or 523-1820. Congratulations on the end of the school year.
Thanks.
And have a successful graduation.
Thank you.
All right, good to see you.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks,